This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 8:59. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University's new Bachelor of Arts in Media and Film Studies, where you can explore how media in all forms affect not only how we view the world, but how we shape it. You learn the power of media and how you can use that power to become a participant in change. Now accepting applications. Details at merrillhurst.edu/KBOO. This program has also been made possible in part by the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events that dig deeper than the far too uncritical reporting and analyses of the conventional media. Today in our program, Bill Resnick talks with Alfredo Lopez from the May 1st organization. They'll be talking about the rapidly expanding security state and the recent revelations of the many forms of communication surveillance that have been so much in the news of late. They'll be talking as well about the liberatory aspects of the communications revolution that unfortunately makes possible such surveillance. Our fiction reviewer, Larry Bolden, is here to discuss a novel by the Italian writer Silvia Avalone entitled Swimming to Elba, about two teenage girls growing up fast in a failing industrial town on the coast of Italy. In the U.S. and Europe, the economic outlook is pretty bleak at present. In the new rapacious global economy, is it even possible for the shrinking U.S. middle and working classes to ever recover a fair share of our aggregate wealth? The socialist senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, wrote a recent editorial in the British Guardian that makes the case that we can overcome such discrepancies. A heads up for all you Trekkies. Movie moles Joe Clement and Fran Michel will conclude our program today reviewing the new Star Trek movie, Star Trek Into Darkness. That film is the second movie in the reboot of the classic sci-fi series. They consider this new film against the history of Star Trek's often progressive, but sometimes not so progressive vision of an egalitarian future. Well, is the security state monitoring our program for subversive content? Probably not yet, but here's Bill Resnick with Alfredo Lopez talking about what it is currently up to.
Thanks, Tom. You know, if they are monitoring us, I want to urge them to become members of KBOO. We're a very diverse organization, and the FBI supported many a left organization in the 60s. Alfredo Lopez, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Alfredo Lopez is one of the founders of the May 1st organization, whose website identifies them as a budding international organization of communication activists and internet users who are challenging corporate state efforts to take over and dominate the whole range of contemporary communications. Their project has not been completed, and it's really challenged. Alfredo Lopez has written on the libertarian democratic potentials of the Internet and the rest of modern contemporary communications. He's also warned on the whole set of them being taken over as tools of oppression, suppression, distraction. Alfredo, give us your sense of the balance right now a sort of overview of the liberatory and also the oppressive uses. Then we can examine each in more detail.
Well, obviously, I think that almost everyone agrees now that we're seeing at least some of the revelations that we're seeing indicate that the government has been extremely aggressive in abusing the purpose of the internet in order to gather information and to finally destroy privacy in the United States. And anyone who visits the internet or uses it can also see the enormous corporate incursion and the attempt by corporations to take over the internet and to use it for a profit, basically. This is the overlining of an entire strategy by both government and corporate forces to contain and control the internet simply because it is so powerful. It has attracted the usage of nearly 2 billion people worldwide. So for political reasons and economic reasons, they want to control it. Now, the important thing for people to remember in this bleak picture is that the reason we know this is happening is because of the power of the internet. The internet is a socially created, the social construct is a socially created technology. It doesn't mean that the entire society sits down and writes the code for it, but those 2 billion people who are participating in it, in fact, participate in making it as popular and powerful as it is. And because people interact with it to make it work, because the purpose of it is to let people know, let others know our opinions and our thinking and about our lives, etc. It's such a participatory communication system, probably the most participatory we've ever had, at least in contemporary times. That is its power. And so nothing can be hidden from us while we have the internet. I mean, they can try, but sooner or later, everything gets out. That's the whole battle. The battleground right now is the internet going to be allowed to do what it was created to do, what the human race created it to do, and fulfill the full potential, politically and socially, that represents, or are the forces of control going to be able to control it? And while they look like they're doing that right now, they are not going to be able to do it. That's what the revelations last week show, and the wildfire of anger and concern that's been expressed around the national security revelations. It just demonstrates that we are fighting back and can fight back to protect this this communication system.
Alfredo, one thing. Talk right into the mic on your phone. Every now and then you fade a little bit. So,
oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
That's okay. It's been fine, actually, and you're understandable. Let's talk about the libertarian a lot more. What are the sort of the manifestations of, I mean, there are political manifestations, for example, the Arab Spring, there are social manifestations, there are heroic people who are struggling to keep it free, there's a international movement to keep the corporation and the state at bay. Why don't you discuss all of that a little more? And then there's the sort of the building consciousness of ordinary people who expect to be free and private. All of those are important. Why don't you talk about them more?
Well, one of the things that's least known or least recognized, although people know about it because they see it and it's visible, they sort of don't make this connection, is that there is a huge movement of activists who are struggling to build the internet, to keep it free, and also to develop software and protocols that protect that freedom. See, this is a little different than other kinds of struggles over freedom I've been involved in all kinds of struggles in the 45 years I've been in the movement. And this is a little different because a lot of this is technological. So, for example, one big issue is whether your software, the software you're using, is owned in a proprietary way by a corporation, or whether it is what we call free and open source. Free and open source software is software that's free. You don't have to pay for it. And also the source code, the code that makes it tick, is open to the public. It can be downloaded, it can be viewed, and in fact, it can even be altered and changed. So we value free and open source software because it's controlled in a democratic way, and it develops in a democratic way. It is effectively part of the model for the kind of society that a lot of us would like to develop and live in. And there are mass movements, I mean, genuine, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people all over the world struggling around these issues. People may have heard, I mean, your listeners may have heard of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which, champions, freedom on the Internet and within technology, legally. And we've been involved, we at Mayfirst have been involved with EFF on several cases that have been particularly nasty and scary that we've needed their help on. And those legal struggles go on all the time. There are movements of technologists, people who do this full time, but of political organizations and political movements that rely heavily on the Internet and want to include Internet matters as part of their political and programmatic agenda. The thing is, Bill, you're right. Most people use the Internet and just expect it to work properly and hopefully to guarantee their freedom. That's exactly what the Internet was developed for. So that's a good thing. But there are many, 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 many people, many more than a lot of people realize, who actually specialize in these kinds of struggles and who organize around it and who, push to expand it and also to protect it. And what's been interesting is that these folks have been voices crying out in the desert very often in the left-wing movement. I mean, people say, a lot of left-wing people say, it definitely should be free. We agree with you. But they didn't see it as a politically important issue, the general left, until last week. For some reason, that spate of revelations about what the government was doing has really, really mobilized a lot of people and sparked a huge amount of concern. And so I think we're going to see all kinds of movements that heretofore have only used technology to begin to make the use and access to technology a major political issue for themselves. So I think this is going to be a new era that we see, at least in the struggle. There is a huge movement around this stuff.
Alfredo, again, please talk right into your microphone on your phone. Excuse me, I have a cold. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Alfredo Lopez of the May 1st organization. We're talking about attempts to maintain free and liberatory communications, and inspiring heroic work of people last week and now in the news today, a fellow named Edward Snowden, who's taking responsibility for the leaks, like Bradley Manning and Julian Assange before. Those people have put themselves out, but there are people all over the world who, in fact, in lesser ways and less publicized ways, are struggling to maintain free communications. Alfredo, let's talk about you've been talking about the Internet, and here we are on the radio. My sense is in a local radio station that challenges the corporate apparatus in this city, Portland, Oregon, but there are local stations all over the country, and we've have networks of them. It seems to me that the internet is so big and there are so many possibilities that and we're inundated in appeals to for our time. Lots and lots of people do not reach our sites. They're not sure what to look at. They're involved in gambling or all of the many kinds of sexual preferences and exploitations that use the internet. They're involved in sports, and in fact, they really aren't reached. My sense is that the internet is powerful today, partly because, and that in fact, dissident sites are reached and people communicate, like in the Arab Spring. You wouldn't have that phenomena unless people had, on a local and national, regional and national levels, identified one another through movements on the ground and through conventional media like the radio. It seems to me the radio, people tune the dial, and they get as they're and they learn about their street actions and all of the politics of the local that way, and that becomes the consciousness basis, or at least that creates a consciousness basis for people who then look for more information on the internet and through the many communications devices. How's that hypothesis?
Well, I mean, I think you're right. It's not, but it's not sequential. I mean, that's important to understand. I think that telecommunications at this point, in terms of the internet, what we call the internet, plays a very central role and sometimes a decisive role in developing consciousness for people. But it can't act alone because it is organic. It is not a technology that is separate from all the other kinds of communications capabilities we have. You and I are talking by phone on what I consider to be probably the single most important mass media capability we have, the radio. Exactly what you said. And as a matter of fact, within many of the coalitions, which Make First People Inc. work, we work hand in hand with people who are doing radio work. There's a huge movement, just like you said, of people working on stations of different bands and networks of stations and all of this other stuff in the radio area that's very, very valuable. In fact, there are many places in this country still where people do not get internet access that easily, but they get radio. Radio is, in my opinion, one of the most important tools we have. however, it becomes richer in interaction with the internet. See, Bill, the thing about the internet is this. There is no communications capability. And most of our communications capability provides us with information. We can get information. And most of us, all of our communications technology allows us some interaction with other people. But what the internet does, it gives an individual the potential of empowering himself or herself with a feeling of value. In other words, with the internet, you can build your own website, you can build your own blog, you can send mass email out, you can do all these other things with your ideas, your thinking, your events, etc.
And you can enter into the dialogue. You're part of this huge multilog of people who are trying, in fact, to express themselves and figure things out together.
That's right. And they listen. See, that's the important thing. In our contemporary capitalist society, one of the things that's robbed of the average human being is the power to be listened to feel that your thinking, your life, and your experience actually is respected, actually can be important to someone, can have an impact on someone else. Once you get that feeling, I've seen it hundreds of times, thousands of times. Once you get that feeling, your whole life changes. Here at May 1st People Inc., we're in what people used to call in our day a ghetto neighborhood. You know, we're in Sunset Park, which is an urban area in Brooklyn, New York. We have a lot of youngsters who are dropouts and, you know, many of them been in trouble with the law. From time to time, come into work here, volunteer, et cetera. We have a very good relationship with a lot of those young men. Although there's some young women as well, in their 20s. These are forgotten people. You sit them down at a computer and you show them how to do a blog and get them to do a little writing. They start learning to write. They start learning to interact. Their life changes. Because all of a sudden, someone reacts to what they're saying. See, this is the power of social media. These kids write something there. I went and had ham and eggs today. And somebody else writes and said, oh, yeah, me too. That me too is as powerful as anything toward making a person feel important. Because our natural state as human beings is to collaborate with others, to be able to impact their thinking, to be able to be impacted and affected by their thinking. And, you know, that's what the Internet gives you. So I think that the Internet has been a drive toward mobilizing a lot of people. I have never seen this movement. I was through the 70s, the legendary 70s, or late 60s, early 70s, when supposedly the movement was never larger than it was to the left-wing movement and everything like that. And I can attest to the fact that the movement is larger today. It's larger today, more powerful in many ways. You know, obviously we're living in a different society, a different stage of history. But you can feel its power. And part of the feeling of power is in the Internet. See, Bill, that's the reason why...
Alfredo, we only have another 3 minutes, and I would like to get to the threats to modern communication, the whole liberatory sphere that the corporate state apparatus is now very vigorously pursuing. Let me ask you one question. This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for The Old Mole, talking to Alfredo Lopez of the May 1st organization. You can find them on their website. You know, those kids who say, I had ham and eggs today, and the other kid who says, me too. And then about 30 seconds later, of course, flashing on the screen is, for ham and eggs, come to Wendy's or McDonald's or someplace else. I mean, everything's being monitored, and they sort of see it. That has both, I don't know, real potentials for resistance when people begin understanding what the nemeses are. But it also is integrative. It gets them into the system. What do you see about best methods of resisting to that entire corporate takeover, including the surveillance and the taking, you know, collecting phone messages and mining data, that whole apparatus? How do we resist?
I mean, the first thing toward resistance is is recognition of the existence of the thing. That's the first thing that you have to do. You have to recognize that these threats actually exist and that they are a threat. A lot of kids will say, oh, yeah, Wendy's, and now I'm going to get my ham and eggs, and they go out and get it. So they have to understand that that is an incursion and what's actually happening when that happens. I mean, that Wendy's is going to, these guys are going to advertise their stuff. That's understandable in capitalism. But that they are collecting the data moment by moment, a second by second, of what you're doing, that means they're actually snooping on every aspect of your life. And so the first thing is to recognize how deep this is and how dangerous it is, not to be blasé about it. The surveillance incursion into our lives centers on progressive movements and movements of resistance. That's what they're surveilling right now. And the recent revelations last week demonstrate clearly that the government is doing this. And one of the interesting things is the arguments or excuses that both the president and General Clapper, James Clapper, gave to explain away these revelations about this prison program and all the rest of this, was based on their absolute belief that people are ignorant about how the internet works. I love Barack Obama personally, but I also recognize him as one of the most repressive presidents in history.
Alfredo, we're going to have to continue this conversation later.
Okay.
We have to get off the air. It's been real enlightening. Thanks a lot for talking to us today, and we'll do it again, particularly unmasking the, exposing the corporate state efforts. Thanks
okay,
a lot.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you so much, Bill.
Right. So long.
And every day it just don't make sense for me to live this way. I've got to stop crying, get up. Ooh, yeah, and walk away.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBO 90.7 FM. Now here's Larry Bolden, our fiction reviewer, with his reading of an international best-selling Italian novel by Silvia Avalon called Swimming to Elba.
Try to imagine a steel mill that takes up 2,500 acres of land, 3 miles of factory fence behind which are acres of decaying buildings and smokestacks, most of them ruined or partly ruined. A place that once employed 20,000 people, but in 2001 is reduced to a skeleton of its former self, with only one of its 4 giant towers still belching toxic clouds of bluish fluorescences, named simply A41. A4, 1, 2, and 3 now mostly just piles of rusting metal. Quote, the posthumous carcasses of the 3 blast furnaces that hadn't yet been dismantled, and down there at the far end, the coke oven, where men shoveled coal by hand, by arm, as if it were still the 19th century. There was no sky. There was an aviary, the purple flames of the furnaces, the swinging arms of the cranes, the tons of metal slung from the hooks beneath the hoisting tackle. The endless rows of sheds, workshop, bunkers, a self-sufficient obsession. The smokestacks, both active and extinct. Overhead, the constant crackling of flames, purple, red, black. The arms of hammerhead cranes swinging around. Yellow-green tons of metal whirling like birds. Yellow clouds of carbon smoke, black at the mouths of the smokestack. It's called continuous integrated steel production. Close quote. This is the setting of Silvia Avalon's best-selling Italian novel, Swimming to Elba, although the meaning of her one-word Italian title is simply steel. I have to admit that I picked it up simply to see what a best-selling Italian novel would consist of, totally unprepared for the powerful social-political statement I was about to encounter. On the face of it, this is a simple novel about 2 inseparable teenage girls, 13, almost 14, both beautiful and both convinced that, quote, the world arrives when you are 14, close quote. Anna is dark and brave and intelligent, Francesca blonde and incredibly beautiful. Both are admired and envied not only by their peers, but by the hungry adult steel mill workers and their already old at 30 or 40 wives. Quote, an expert eye would have immediately sensed that this kind of beauty lasts for only a moment in the course of a lifetime. But in that crowd, there were no expert eyes, close quote. The 2 girls live in a factory town at the edge of the sea in one of a set of huge concrete barracks that had been constructed 40 years earlier by a public housing authority when government was in the hands of Christian Democrats and Italian communists. Quote, the public housing authority had built the giant barracks lining the beaches for the workers at the steel mills. Even metal workers, according to the views of the local communist administration, administration had the right to an apartment with a view of the sea, not a view of the factory, close quote. While much of this novel is aimed at revealing the sad lives of the women and girls who are the abused girlfriends and wives of the metal workers, it is clear that Avalon is also fascinated by and sympathetic towards the boys and men who live and work inside of the mills, a world that no one outside can really understand. Certainly she's critical of the rich bosses who profit from the blood and lives of the men who work in the bowels of the factory, owners who would never deign to dirty themselves in the nearly inconceivable conditions inside, and who are willing to shut down, downsize, and outsource at the whims of world market economies. But her fascination with the entire process of making steel and with the history of the industry is much more complex than her mistrust of an economic system that exploits workers. Quote, 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit is the melting point of steel alloy. Steel doesn't exist in nature. It's not an elementary substance. It's a secretion of thousands of human hands, electric meters, mechanical arms, and every so often the skin of a cat that's tumbled into the molten alloy, close quote. Although there's a large cast of characters in the book, it is the stories of Francesca and Anna and of their two families that provide the main focus. Anna's mother, Sandra, is socially and politically informed, active in Communist Party politics, and eager for her daughter to get an education and escape the cycle of poverty and abuse of most of the women around her. Sandra is disappointed that her son, Alessio, has already given up on any life outside the mill and is destined to a life of running one of the huge cranes that move the metal in various of its incarnations. Her husband has escaped the factory, but only by turning to criminal activities in the hopes of providing a better life for his wife and children. Francesca's father, Enrico, a giant of a man who left the poor life of rural farming to make his fortune in the mills, spends his time worrying about his too beautiful daughter and flying into rages that lead to beatings of his long-abused wife Rosa and of Francesca. Quote, just an ordinary man who had left the country with a rucksack on his shoulders to come to the city, close quote. As the two girls grow up, they dream someday of crossing the water to Elba, the rich sister city and tourist destination that seems to hold the answers to their dreams. Francesca, who loves Anna not simply as a sister, but secretly as a would-be lover, is contemptuous and nauseated by the attention she receives from the boys and grown men who constantly undress her with their eyes. She hopes that her beauty will provide an escape from her present life and win her Anna's romantic love. Anna understands that her beauty alone will not save her. She sees the strength of her mother and, at least on some level, takes in the message that only education and coming to understand the social realities can help her to a better life. This is a powerful book. While it may have become a bestseller, at least partly because of the titillation of peeking into the lives of two beautiful girls who are on the cusp of womanhood, its ultimate appeal rests on the lucidity of Avalon's understanding of the world around her. There is so much of interest in this book that my comments have at best merely scratched the surface. Let me close with a quote from the book that summarizes Avalon's own questions about her characters and the industrial city in which she was raised. Quote, what does it mean to grow up in a complex of four big tenements, shedding sections of balconies and chunks of asbestos into a courtyard where little kids play alongside older kids dealing drugs and old people who reek of decay? What kind of vision do you get of the world in a place where it's normal not to go anywhere on vacation, not to go to the movies, not to know anything about the world, to never read the newspaper, to never read a book? And that's just how life is. The two of them in this place sought each other out, chose each other. Close quote. I've been talking about Sylvia Avalon's novel Swimming to Elba. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Come on, come on, come on, come on, let's talk about it, talk about it, talk about it.
Well, that was the OJs setting up the next piece. The song is called The Rich Get Richer. Last week in Britain's Guardian newspaper, Socialist U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders warned of a growing complacency in the U.S. that the current weak economic recovery that is currently taking place is the best that can be expected in a global economy in which U.S. dominance is rapidly deteriorating. They must simply accept and learn to live with ever-increasing wealth disparity, make do with low-paying jobs that lack adequate retirement benefits, and accept the most inefficient and by multiples the most expensive healthcare system in the world. Sanders argues that it is not to be our future, we must overcome our complacency, or in his words, and the title of his article, we must not accept this new economic normal. Yes, the economy is improving, Sanders begins, but too many Americans are being left behind while the rich keep getting richer. The front pages of American newspapers are filled with stories about how the U.S. economy is recovering. There is some truth to that. Since President George W. Bush left office in 2009, significant progress has been made in moving our economy out of the abyss of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. But in the midst of this slow recovery, we must not accept a new normal. We must not be content with an economic reality in which the middle class of this country continues to disappear. Poverty is near an all-time high, and the gap between the very rich and everyone else grows wider and wider. The good news is that instead of losing more than 700,000 jobs a month, as we were 5 years ago, we've been gaining almost 200,000 jobs a month since January. The bad news is that in addition to those job numbers being much too low, nearly 60% of the jobs gained since the recovery are low-wage jobs that pay less than $14 an hour, while most of the jobs lost during the recession were decent-paying middle-class jobs. Good news is that the official employment rate has gone down from 10% in October of 2009 to 7.5% in April. The bad news is that 20 million Americans still are looking for work, and the real unemployment rate, counting those who have given up looking for work and those working part-time when they need full-time jobs, is 13.9%. The very bad news is that youth and minority unemployment is far higher than that, and with the decline of factory jobs, income for poorly educated men has shrunk by nearly two-thirds over the last four decades. The good news is that housing prices are beginning to rise, providing some additional wealth for most homeowners. The bad news is that from 2009 to 2011, all of the new wealth generated in this country went to the top 7% of American households, while the bottom 93% saw a net reduction in their wealth. Further, the U.S. has more wealth inequality than any major country on earth, with the top 1% now owning 38% of the financial wealth, while the bottom 60% owns just 2.3% of the wealth. The good news is that the stock market has fully recovered from its collapse in 2008 and is now at an all-time high. The bad news is that the top 1% of Americans earn more income than the bottom 50%, and 100% of the new income generated in this country from 2009 to 2011 went to the top 1%. During that period, the bottom 99% of Americans lost ground economically. The good news is that since 2008, the deficit has been cut by more than half. In 2008, it was $1.4 trillion. This year it will be about $642 billion. The bad news is that many working-class families can no longer afford the outrageously high cost of college, and the average American student leaves school with about $25,000 in debt, with graduate students running debts far higher. The good news is that if you are a CEO of a large corporation, you are now making 350 times more than your average employee. The bad news is that unemployment benefits have been cut, making it harder for the long-term unemployed to live in dignity. The American people get the economic realities. According to a Gallup poll, nearly 6 out of 10 believe that money and wealth should be more evenly distributed among a larger percentage of the people in the U.S., while only a third of Americans think the current distribution is fair. A record-breaking 52% of the American people believe that the federal government should redistribute wealth by heavy taxes on the rich. The United States Congress and the President must begin listening to the American people. While there clearly has been some improvement in the economy over the last 5 years, much more needs to be done. We need a major jobs program which puts billions back to work rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. We need to tackle the planetary crisis of global warming by creating jobs transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels and into energy efficiency and sustainable energy. We need to end the scandal of one of four corporations paying nothing in federal taxes while we balance the budget on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. That was an article by Bernie Sanders, the socialist U.S. Senator from Vermont, entitled, "We Must Not Accept the New Normal." The article appeared in last Sunday's Guardian newspaper. And now, concluding our program today, Movie Moles Fran Michel and Joe Clement give us their take on Star Trek Into Darkness. The Movie Moles have asked me to tell you that there may be spoilers, but let's be honest, you probably will have forgotten them by the time you get to the theater. So now, let's boldly go where no reviewers have gone before.
Space, a final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Joe Clement to discuss Star Trek Into Darkness, the second film in the rebooted Star Trek franchise directed by J.J. Abrams. We will be giving away plot points. Spoiler warning, spoiler warning, spoiler warning. The film features Benedict Cumberbatch as Khan, a genetically engineered superhuman, secretly enlisted by Admiral Marcus to design ships and weapons for the as-yet-unstarted war between the Federation and the Klingon Empire, which Marcus wants to strike preemptively. Khan, however, has escaped and begun to engage in acts of terrorism against the Federation, so Marcus sends the Enterprise on a covert mission to kill him, armed with 72 prototype torpedoes. Logical Spock persuades passionate Captain Kirk to capture rather than kill Khan and bring him back to Earth for a fair trial. And Khan gives Kirk information that leads to the discovery that the torpedoes contain Khan's crewmates in cryogenic stasis, and that a secret shipyard behind Jupiter holds a massive warship, the Vengeance, despite the Federation's officially peaceful policies. Angry that Khan has not been killed, Marcus, in the dreadnought Vengeance, pursues the Enterprise, but Kirk and Khan sneak aboard and take the bridge, where Khan turns on Kirk and kills Marcus. But the Enterprise crew have removed the cryotubes and armed the torpedoes, so they fire on the Vengeance and keep the frozen crew. Kirk saves the Enterprise from crashing to Earth by exposing himself to fatal radiation while realigning the warp core. And meanwhile, the Vengeance plows into downtown San Francisco. Khan survives this, and his super blood is used to reanimate the dead Kirk, while Khan himself is refrozen. Kirk gives a speech about the importance of not becoming like one's enemies by seeking revenge, and the Enterprise goes off to its five-year mission. The film ends with a title card dedicating it to post-9/11 veterans. So this is the 12th film in the Star Trek franchise. What makes this such an appealing universe for fans?
Well, the original Star Trek series came out at a time when the civil rights movement was really hot, when people's agitation against injustices in the world was pretty hot, and where the question of the future, because of the space race being hot as well, all came together, I think, to create a condition where people are ready to think about what the future is really going to be like. And Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek to be much more than just a TV show. I think that Star Trek has always been kind of a very self-consciously, even politically motivated experiment in futurology that tried to make a lot of science fiction possibilities accessible to people while also being, you know, fun.
And it was egalitarian in its, to some extent, in its presentation of race. At least it was integrated, which in 1966, not too many shows were, I think. So there was Uhura, and there was Sulu at the helm. And so we had characters of color who were in significant roles. They were not the leads. They were not the captain. But they had major roles. So there was an attempt at that kind of egalitarianism and integration.
And at the same time, I think that it might be saying a bit much to say that they had really major roles. Uhura, you know, was on the bridge, and yet she was essentially a 23rd century receptionist.
Yes.
for the spaceship. This is not to downplay the fact that it's immense that they were on screen, but to kind of think of how do we look at historical representations of people from oppressed backgrounds and assess whether they are getting fair treatment or not.
Exactly. And that's sort of the question with, or that's related to the question about the casting of Khan in this film, in Star Trek Into Darkness, because it was originally a role played by Ricardo Montalbán, a Mexican actor, character of color, and it's been recast with a white actor. So on the one hand, it's whitewashing. He's not there anymore. And he was one of the more complex, interesting, appealing villains in Star Trek. On the other hand, well, having people of color playing the villains is not necessarily the greatest thing in the world either. So at least we have a sense in this film that, yeah, the white guys are doing some bad stuff. So there's that as well. I mean, on the one hand, you have the question of any representation, at least actors of color are getting work. I mean, at the most basic material level, there's that. And they're certainly not central characters. As you say, Uhura, she's a receptionist. Sulu's the chauffeur. I don't know. But they're there more than they were in a lot of other shows in the 1960s. And I guess Star Trek, the original series, had the first interracial kiss on television. It was choreographed by aliens as part of some torturous process.
They didn't want to do it.
They didn't want to do it, but still, they did it, you know, and it was on television. So they made some efforts in that direction, and I think it's worth acknowledging that, even though clearly it did not go. I mean, Uhura was not captaining the ship, and she was wearing those very, very short skirts. All the women were in the little mini skirts, which seems like impractical wear for outer space. I don't know. And this film, too, although it has, you know, female science officers and female officers in Starfleet, it does not pass the Bechdel test, in which you have to have at least two named female characters who talk to each other about something other than a man. The women in this film do not talk to each other at any point, and there's only a couple of them, really. And then, of course, there's the scene in which Carol Marcus disrobes for no... I can't even remember when in the film she does that, which is, I think, an indication of how completely gratuitous it is. She looks good in her 23rd century underwear, which looks a lot like 21st century underwear.
And we still have the male gaze.
And we still have the male gaze. So there are attempts at egalitarianism, but it's not quite as progressive as it would like to be, or as it might be, or as it should be.
Then you fast forward to Into Darkness, and the principal bad guy is a military admiral who has run amok. It's not even very clear why he wants to start a war with the Klingons, other than at this point in Federation history, nobody likes the Klingons.
Well, they're violent, you know. They have tempers.
Right.
those Klingons, they have violent tempers. I mean, that's one of the things about the representation of aliens on Star Trek, as in much science fiction, that alien species are coded in terms of particular races or characteristics of people on Earth. And so they become very sort of homogenized and stereotypical. So
it's interesting to look at the series as a whole, but especially the kind of core Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and even Voyager iterations in terms of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, because the way that intelligent hominoid races arise on planets leads to these very unified, homogenous cultures that have very kind of characteristic things that people can, you know, refer to at a glance, in the way that, you know, 50, 100 years ago, we might have referred to the typical things to expect of Irish people or people from Africa or Chinamen.
Star Trek also promised this united planet, and we're all in this together. We've overcome Cold War divisions. It is also, of course, the captain is an American white guy, and the famous phrase about their mission is that they are pursuing the final frontier. And so it reflects American sense of mission and manifest destiny and controlling the world. So it is this kind of imperialist mission, even though then that's countered, or supposedly countered, by the prime directive of Starfleet, which is that they are not supposed to interfere with other cultures. So it's sort of supposed to be a kind of check on the imperialism suggested by the final frontier. And yet Kirk and the Enterprise, they're constantly violating the prime directive. And in Star Trek Into Darkness, the first scene is about them violating the Prime Directive in order to save these people by stopping the volcano from erupting so that they don't all get washed away. So they break the rules, but it's really to be helpful. This film is I guess, one of the only ones in which one of a very few, or maybe the only instance in which Kirk gets called on the carpet for having violated the Prime Directive. And usually he gets away with it. It's just, you know, it was the right thing to do, even though he wasn't following the rules.
And he gets away with it because one thing that figures prominently in this movie, as one reviewer put it, is Dadmirals. There is this very in-crowd that protects their own. Kirk got into Starfleet because he had these connections through Admiral Pike, and Pike again has come through to, you know, make sure that he got a second chance, which, you know, maybe we can see in terms of the story that he deserves. But when we think about how this is representing power in an ostensibly, you know, transparent egalitarian society, it raises questions that I think we should be asking, which is what's great about Star Trek, actually. It's not just a vision of society perfected. I think that we have to keep in mind Ursula K. Le Guin's introduction to The Left-Handed Darkness, where she talks about how science fiction at its best is really a thought experiment about what we have at present, and that what Star Trek does is it brings our best and arguably some of our worst, masquerading as our best, into full view for us to actually consider.
And this film, the Star Trek Into Darkness, does that in some fairly explicit ways with some fairly obvious evocations of the current war on terrorism and the era of post 9/11. So when the Vengeance ship goes crashing through San Francisco, there are these billowing clouds of gray smoke that reflect, you know, what you would have seen when the plane landed at the Pentagon or crashed into the Twin Towers in New York. So there is this resonance there.
And then you have Simon Pegg's character Scotty, who at one point, you know, takes this very noble stand against just following orders when he knows that his orders, which are to simply allow these torpedoes to be loaded onto the Enterprise, when he knows these orders are against the rules and they're just generally, from a practical standpoint, a bad idea. He wants to inspect them, make sure they're not dangerous. And there is this very, I think, intentional message being put off there that corrupt governments will just try and push their workers along to get them to cooperate, and that the real heroes are those workers, those everyday people who say no.
Yeah, there's that sort of anti-bureaucratic dimension to the film. And clearly the worst villain here is Admiral Marcus, is this figure who's very high up in Starfleet, who has a lot of power and is plotting to start a war with the Klingons. Perhaps because he thinks it's coming anyway, it's sort of a preemptive thing, a la Cheney Bush, that we have to go get them before they get us because they're about to attack us. He's clearly not represented in, I don't think there's anything positive about his representation as a character. And there are explicit messages in the film about the dangers of seeking revenge and the problem of simply going in and assassinating somebody you believe to have done you harm, and speeches in favor of the value of pursuit of law and putting people on trial if they've done something wrong and not having the death penalty. And yet this terrorist figure is somewhat sympathetic insofar as he has been wronged by Marcus. He's been used. He's been exploited. His comrades have been taken away from him. He thinks they may all be dead. So we have some sympathy for him, although he goes on to do some things that lose that sympathy completely. And yet, because the film is dedicated to the veterans of the post 9/11 era, and because I think a lot of the charge of the film comes from watching things explode, it's kind of a mixed message. And also nothing, I mean, Marcus dies, he's killed by Khan, but he's not, there's no inspection of Starfleet or discussion of how we can keep this sort of thing from happening again. He's sort of a rogue general commander, and yet there's no attempt to make sure that someone else can't do that too.
No, and that just underscores one of the differences between this movie and the original series, or the majority of Star Trek, is that there's not the same kind of accountability structures in a couple of the original movies. There was, you know, explicit references to court martials and the law, and trials themselves are a recurring kind of trope in story construction in Star Trek. But in this new movie, it's all about the good old boys.
Yeah, we never see Khan go on trial. Apparently, they decide to just refreeze him. We don't, although he's been brought back to Earth ostensibly so that he can be brought to justice, the only justice we see him getting is there he is, he's frozen again. So, although he's not executed, he's not really living anymore, and it's not clear how that came about. So it's clearly not centered on questions of legality and justice and law, despite its pronouncements to the contrary.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, but it would be fun to come back to and periodically explore some of the more radical visions that Star Trek has thrown out. There's a great Union episode in the Deep Space Nine series. There is a radical interrogation of exploitative economics in the original series. And these are some of the things that really make Star Trek worth, you know, putting some time into.
The vast universe of Star Trek.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement and Fran Michel talking about Star Trek Into Darkness.
So why do about the government and the FBI scanning your screen? So what are you, buddy, a commie or a green? And why do you mistrust the government? Oh, delay.
Well, that was The Fugs with a song called Government Surveillance. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This program will be podcast on the KPU website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And this is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Next, at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia with locally produced news, interviews, and just plain horse sense with Chris Andrea. At 10:15, we're here at Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is veteran journalist Judith Swartz, author of Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to heal the Earth. Find out how cows can help today on Locus Focus. At 11, it's Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today's guest is psychotherapist Gary Greenberg, author of the new book, The Book of Woe, An Insider's Challenge to Psychiatry's Scientific Pretensions. And at 11:30, we'll hear the Monday Morning Radio Zine with host Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Jim Wallace, founder of Sojourner Magazine and the author of the book entitled On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good.
This traces back to Magna Carta 800 years ago. Magna Carta had two components. One is the Charter of Liberties, famous one, which I discussed, the foundation of Anglo-American law now being torn to shreds before our eyes. The other part is what was called the Charter of Forests. Now, that was dedicated to protection of the commons from the ravages of the power centers of the day.
That's Noam Chomsky, Magna Carta, Then and Now, on the next Alternative Radio. Tune into Alternative Radio this Tuesday at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO Portland.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. It is also in a new location in Philomath and on a new frequency. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.